There's the big board, the 20 electoral votes from the state of Pennsylvania. We just got new metrics in.
The inauguration of a president celebrates a peaceful transition of power engineered by the American voters.
This is your life now. This is our election now. This is us. This is our country. It's real.
Hi, and welcome back, listeners of the 45th Podcast. I'm excited to be back this week with my co-host, Sara, who was missing last week because you were up to a lot, right? What was going on?
I was schlepping myself from my house to a storage, first time ever, so.
It's very glamorous.
Yeah.
No, but is this your new house? Did you finally move into your new place?
No, I'm actually in transition, so it's under construction and just waiting for, you know, things to be done in maybe about 2 weeks, and fingers crossed that nothing happens.
No, fingers crossed for you. And again, my offer for my basement and my sofa anytime you need. You can come
on. You live in the boonies, girlfriend.
No, I am exactly 7 miles away from DC. So let's, but okay, there's a lot of trees out here. That is true. Well, I'm also very excited this week because we have a new guest with us. So our guest this week is Mr. Siraj Hashmi, and he is the assistant editor for Red Alert Politics, which is an online publication based out of Washington, D.C., and it covers conservative news for millennials, which is pretty interesting. He can be found on redalertpolitics.com, and you can also find Red Alert Politics on Twitter. Their handle is @RedAlert, and there's Siraj's own personal Twitter, which I follow and retweet all the time, which is @SirajAHashmi. Siraj, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Robbie and Sara.
Thanks for being flexible and joining us, and I hope this is not your first time. I hope you come on the show repeatedly, because you know what? Sara is the only lonely conservative here.
I'm sorry to hear that, Sara.
Hey, there'll be more of us soon. Don't worry.
We Muslim conservatives and libertarians need to stick together.
Yeah.
So can I just say, so you just outed yourself, Siraj. Today's show is the first time we've had like only Muslims on the show. Me and then Sara and you. But it's one liberal and two conservatives. So I still think it's diverse. I don't care what people have to say.
Yeah.
Now, here's the thing, though, Siraj. I've known you for a few years, but I'll be honest. I did not know you were a conservative.
I'm not actually that conservative. I probably more subscribe to the libertarian ideology. So before I was at Red Alert Politics, for our listeners, I was at a small media startup that doesn't exist anymore. It's called GVH Live. And I had both Rabia and Wajahat Ali on to talk about Islamophobia. And that's just kind of how things started. And I kind of got connected with everyone in the Muslim community from that. And since then, I've kind of just tried to not solely talk about Muslim issues. I really wanted to focus on politics and in general politics, which is great that you guys are doing a podcast focusing on the president of the United States. It would have been interesting to see if this podcast would exist under Obama or even Bush. Of course, podcasting never really came into fruition until the last decade.
Well, I'll just so you know, we've already got the domain name, the 46th, reserved.
Oh, there you go.
Just in case.
In case it's either Pence or the person who votes him out.
Exactly. One or the other. So, yeah, we hopefully will go on that long. So we met when you were doing that work. But is your career mostly around political stuff, or like what's your background?
Right. So I am actually not typically a political journalist by trade. I went to Dickinson College for undergrad. I actually wanted to become a doctor, a medical doctor. I majored in biology, graduated with a degree in biology, came down to D.C. to go to Georgetown for a year in a post-baccalaureate pre-medical program. I did that, and that was around 2010. And then I started working at a sleep lab where people, with sleep apnea or insomnia, you go there and you sleep and we study you. Can be very creepy if, you've never heard of these sleep disorders.
I took my daughter to one recently.
Oh, okay.
So the only creepy thing was the pillows. I'm glad I got my own.
Yeah, they can be kind of Motel 6-ish, but I had a really pretty rewarding experience. But at the same time, my drive for wanting to go to medical school sort of died there. And I decided I wanted to actually go into something like broadcasting. I actually wanted to do sports. So I started working at a small sports media startup just in Maryland. And it was in Ellicott City. And we focused on high school sports, particularly high school football.
Oh, I didn't know about that. Okay.
Yeah. So I did that For about a year and a half, I wasn't making any money. So I also worked as an insurance agent, and I did some teaching on the side too to try to make money. That was around 2013. And then in 2014, I started with GVH Live, which is where I met Rabia. And I was there for about over 2 years, actually. And I also worked at SiriusXM Radio during that time in the mornings from 5 to 9 a.m. on a political talk show called The Morning Briefing, which is hosted by Tim Farley on the POTUS channel. It's channel 124, if you've ever listened to it or wanted to go listen to it. It's just kind of down the middle talk radio. We had a funny story. While I was working there, Steve Bannon was also working there too, hosting the Breitbart News Daily in the mornings from 6 to 9 a.m. And so I run into him in the hallways.
Wait. You just said it was a down the middle news. That doesn't seem down the middle.
Not Steve Bannon's program. So POTUS is their nonpartisan channel. Then they have Patriot, is their right of center conservative political talk news channel. So you have people like Breitbart. They have like a rotating cast, but it was really Steve Bannon. And then they had Matt Boyle for a while. They also had like David Webb. I think Sean Hannity's program was on there, and Mark Levin. But I'd see Steve Bannon almost every day for over the course of like a year and a half, until at least he was brought on to the Trump campaign as the chief executive.
Did that surprise you, shock you, scare you?
So what really was kind of opened my eyes about Steve Bannon was when the whole Michelle Fields incident happened. And when Corey Lewandowski, who was then the Trump campaign manager, allegedly grabbed her and she wrote about it.
Right.
Steve Bannon and many of the Breitbart head executives did not stand behind the reporter, leading her to quit, as well as another big name conservative, Ben Shapiro, who left and started his own brand called The Daily Wire. But then I would still see him in the hallways, and I just would never approach him because I wasn't sure, you know, how he would. People kind of live by, you know, they're known by their reputations, but they might be completely different in person. A lot of people were saying these things about Steve Bannon. A lot of it just seemed to be true. But however, every time I've run into him in the hallways, I'd always like say good morning, like, hey, how you doing? And he always returned, you know, pleasantries. So it was never really an issue until like he then got hired by the Trump campaign. And I was reading all this like horrifying material about him. And I'm like, oh my God, he did all that. Like, and so I just never.
I will say this, Siraj. I mean, it's really nice that he returned pleasantries, but that is a low bar to give somebody brownie points for.
I mean, I know this podcast is listen only, but if people were to see me, they would just think that I'm just look so like white.
A white guy. You look like a white guy.
I could blend in anywhere, and it's true. I could just blend in anywhere, and no one would know the difference. So in the case of Steve Bannon, like if I had a full on beard, was a little bit darker, we could then probably test that hypothesis and see if he would return the pleasantries.
See, next time you run into him, you got to like do it in that whole in that kind of getup. But Sarah and I both know your brother actually also for a number of years, Razi. And Razi actually worked with, and by the way, I just got to point out, I don't know if Razi was also aiming to go to medical or to become a doctor like
me.
I don't know, Sarah, were you? I mean, we're like basically all failed medical students. It's such a South Asian thing, a Muslim thing.
No, not in my family. We don't
not in your family?
We don't have the science genes.
Oh, no. It was such a disappointment when I went to law school. But Razi actually worked in the Obama administration, right? He's been in the political world for a while.
Well, and now he's in the Trump administration in the State Department. He but he's a career employee, so he's not a political appointee in the same sense that, like, you have been hired by the Obama administration or the Trump administration. It just so happens that he was well connected with people in the Obama administration so that he could get a career placement.
Wow. I thought he was a PMF. Hmm.
He actually was a PMF, Presidential Management Fellowship, for those who don't know.
Yeah, we talked about that last week. Actually,
oh, okay, great.
That program,
so hopefully,
being frozen.
Yeah, that's crazy. Yeah, he had some opinions on that.
We're going to actually start off with a little bit of a weekly roundup. I mean, like every week, you know, the news cycle is exhausting, and, you know, for you as a journalist, I'm sure it keeps you on your toes 24 hours a day. You're doing this every day. We do this once a week, and it's exhausting. I pulled about four or five, I thought, some of the things that kind of caught my eye, and I would love to hear your thoughts about them. But there's been a lot of big news, I think, this week. And we can start off with news about something that happened. We found out that the FBI had raided the home of the campaign, former campaign, Trump campaign chair, Paul Manafort. And the reports say this, that, you know, special counsel Robert Mueller, the raid was conducted at his direction. He carried out an early morning search at the home of Manafort, and that FBI agents seized documents and other materials that were related specifically to taxes and foreign banking. It was an unannounced raid, as raids are supposed to be. It did require a federal judge to approve a search warrant based on probable cause. So these raids can't just happen willy-nilly. There needs to be a little bit of due diligence beforehand and proving probable cause that there's evidence of a crime, which is a sign that this investigation, all the Russia stuff, is kind of getting intense. Why an FBI raid? You know, those kinds of things happen for a couple different reasons. Jonathan Turley, he's a law professor at GW, and many people have been opining about this, but he said that the search probably means that prosecutors are ratcheting up the pressure on Manafort. It might be an indication that, unlike some reports saying that he has maybe flipped, that he hasn't, that he's not being very cooperative, it could be a way to pressure him, but you know, at the end of the day, the underlying basis for such a raid is that there's some probable cause. What did you guys think when you heard this news?
I wasn't that surprised. I mean, the time frame wasn't surprising. It was July, which is very close to around, you know, the time that it was pretty established that there was stuff that need to be looked into. So if it had been done like a year or two ago, I'd be like, But, you know, obviously.
I was more or less surprised.
You were?
Yeah, I mean, FBI raids are not typical when investigating someone on politics. I mean, I guess if you're talking about Paul Manafort, who probably has, you know, the biggest target on his back outside of Trump, the subpoena being withdrawn, I thought that was kind of that brought up a red flag. I probably should have seen it coming that, you know, something else was going to happen in turn. It happened like less than 24 hours after they withdrew the subpoena to testify.
Right.
Before the Senate, I believe it was going to be a closed door hearing. But still, you know, when you talk about FBI raids, usually you think of something that's a little bit more dangerous than, say, something like bank fraud or, you know, embezzlement or, you know, in this case, collusion with the Russians.
Well, I will say this. I mean, like, you know, when your home is raided, I mean, when law enforcement raids your home, there's a couple different reasons that happen. Number one, I mean, like, they might also be afraid that, you know, there's evidence that they need that you are either not turning over, you're not complying with subpoenas, but also that you might destroy. And so, you know, this is one of ensuring that, you know, if it's done at least early enough, they'll get the evidence that will help them proceed forward in the case. We talked last week about the grand jury that's being impaneled. I mean, you said that Manafort's got this big red target on his back. I mean, like, Flynn is probably competing for that title as well. Yeah, and you know, any evidence that's found in this kind of raid, that seized in this kind of raid, can also be used in investigations against other concerned parties too. But yeah, that was kind of harrowing news. But then also, there was apparently another raid that happened in late February, and the news just broke about it this past week. And I thought this was kind of interesting because the FBI in late February raided the offices of Duncan Hunter, who is a Republican legislator from California. They raided his campaign treasurer's offices as part of an ongoing criminal investigation into allegations that Hunter used tens of thousands of dollars in campaign funds for personal expenses. Okay. So they say that federal law enforcement officials on February 23rd seized computers, tablets, iPads, bills, disbursement records, a computer hard drive, and a bunch of other stuff. And they did this from a Alexandria, Virginia-based company that handled Hunter's campaign finances. So you guys think there's any connection here?
I don't think there's a connection with Russia. Probably just his own indiscretion. I mean, he did vape during a hearing, if you recall correctly.
No, I did not know that.
Oh, yeah. He is, of all the congressmen and women serving in the House and Senate, I believe he is one of the only people to vape during a congressional hearing, which is obviously criminal, and he should be punished and put to death. But, you know,
wait a minute, how? That is really a weird bit of, was that like just kind of like a rebellious move, or is this like whatever?
No, I think it was actually like, there was actually a hearing about vaping. in. But Duncan Hunter, who's one of the few very pro-Trump congressional Republicans currently serving in the House, if anything, you could probably make the case that the FBI, which in some cases people believe has been politicized, is targeting pro-Trump Republicans in any way that they can through whether campaign finance, which if you think about campaign finance laws, almost everyone breaks a campaign finance law.
I tried to bring that up once, and I got chopped for it.
No, you don't get chopped for it. But the point is, just because everybody doesn't mean it's okay.
It's just like everybody speeding, right? And not everybody gets caught. But if you're like,
there's a big difference between going 35 in a school zone and taking campaign money to like pay for, you know.
Right, and you know you saw a vacation.
And you saw
people like Aaron Schachtu, who resigned in 2014 for basically redecorating his office to the form of Downton Abbey. And you know, it just brings shame on like us millennials who like just want to be taken seriously, but we just happen to like use all this money to live lavishly and end up taking campaign money. Who knew that was a crime? That right?
But you know, Robbie, the reason I'm not surprised really is because this is a testament to Mueller doing his job. I mean, that's what he was hired to do, and I think things have been moving since then. So I know that we won't find out exactly what came out of those raids or what kind of initiated them at a public level maybe, but I do think that he's doing his job, and I think he's going to continue to do a fantastic job. I think that transparency and the fact that these things are happening just proves that we picked the right person.
Well, I'm glad you think that Mueller's doing a good job. I mean, I think, you know, that he's also getting attacked a lot by the right, but I will say that this particular raid probably had nothing to do with, Mueller. I mean, the second raid, I think, happened before he was appointed, but also he's special counsel on a different issue. But here's the thing, you know, Siraj, you said that he's one of the most pro-Trump, but he's also, and maybe because he's pro-Trump, he's also kind of pro-Russia. He's written like an op-ed in which he talks about, you know, well, maybe Trump should be allowed to work with Russia. I mean, he has never really been critical also of Trump's lack of criticism for Russia. And I wonder, I mean, like, it's odd to hear a U.S. legislator speak like, you know, about Putin like that, that, hey, give the man a chance.
Yeah. I mean, if this were, what, 50 years ago in the Cold War, this man would have been crucified. You know,
I see what you're doing there.
Well, what's interesting, though, is that, you know, Duncan Hunter, despite his, you know, ambitions for Trump to want to work with Russia, you know, I think in some ways, yes, the president should try to work on a diplomatic level rather than an aggressive level with every nation that, you know, they face. I mean, Obama even said it back, I think it was 2008 when he was debating McCain, that when it came to Iran, that he would engage in talks with them with no conditions, rather than, you know, set conditions, right, say, on like their nuclear program. And I think the same should be held with Trump and with Russia. I mean, I know
you can't hold him to those standards. So he's not made of the same material.
I know he's not made of the same material, but I'm just saying the office of the president in this case should be held.
Well, if he had good advisors showing him how to do it, that would help.
But Siraj, you believe that's the case even in the face of overwhelming evidence that Russia has and continues to like interfere in our political process?
I understand the negative connotation. Well, here's the thing. With Russia kind of implementing their slant on the election and the electoral process, again, they didn't hack any machines. I know a lot of people like to talk about how they hacked the election. They didn't hack the election. They get into WikiLeaks, supposedly got emails from John Podesta and the DNC and posted them. And the causal link that people can't really corroborate as the link between Julian Assange of WikiLeaks and Vladimir Putin. That's the one outlier right now that it's hard to really say with 100% confidence that Russia hacked the election or hacked the electoral process. So with that being said, and with Trump president, do we really want to get a Cold War part two? And I think for most people, at least on the Democratic side, it seems like they're already in that frame of mind. for Republicans, they're kind of wishy-washy on it because obviously you have people like Duncan Hunter who thinks we should engage, and you have people like John McCain and Lindsey Graham who are like, no, we got to, you know, stick it to them. This Russia sanctions bill that Trump signed. I mean, I think he kind of signed it reluctantly. I don't think he really wanted to sign it. I think he definitely wanted to sign it for North Korea and Venezuela. Mm-hmm. But Russia just seemed like too much, but because it's poor optics.
I mean, he almost apologized for
it. Yeah, but then, so what? What was that whole thing of removing all those employees of the, you know, the U.S.?
That was ridiculous. U.S. diplomats. I think most people on both sides of the aisle like, what are you saying with, you know, thanking Putin?
No, I want to thank him because we're trying to cut down on payroll. And as far as I'm concerned, I'm very thankful that he let go of a large number of people because now we have a smaller payroll. There's no real reason for them to go back. So I greatly appreciate the fact that they've been able to cut our payroll for the United States. We'll save a lot of money.
Let's talk about this a little bit. I thought this was kind of shocking because, you know, okay, I'll tell you the truth. I read the headlines and I thought, you know what? He probably was being sarcastic or joking. And then I saw it and I listened to it and our audience just listened to it. It doesn't seem like tongue in cheek at all. I mean, it seems like he is like, this is serious. He seems serious about this.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. So forget about those poor people who don't have jobs right now.
750 plus people, right?
And yeah, the thing is actually that I don't think they're actually not off the payroll. I think they're still on the payroll, but just
they're somewhere in the State Department.
It matches his whole thing of draining the swamp, cutting down the bureaucracy. So to him, it's just like, okay, that makes it easier for us.
Really? You really think that's what this is about, Sarah?
No, it's his nonchalant.
That Putin clearly has some kind of something over Trump that terrifies him. And no matter what Putin does, Trump says, yep, great job. Thank you.
No, I just honestly think this man doesn't value diplomacy as much enough to worry about, you know, where the diplomatic corps is in that country. Seriously.
Saraj, how did you read this situation? How did you read this?
I thought it was... And the White House aides, they actually, through sources, they said that he was being sarcastic. I don't think I really buy that. I don't know if Putin actually has something over Trump's head, but I know that...
I don't think so. I really don't.
I think Trump is trying to appease him in any way that he possibly can.
Why?
Why? I think he...
He's got enough problems to deal with.
There is nobody that Trump will not attack. Like, nobody. That he will... Putin is literally the only figure in the world that he backs down from. Why?
Well, listen, Trump has had business relationships with Russian citizens that date back to before his presidency. And you don't know what kind of ties those are and if they indirectly are related to his ties with Putin. And he doesn't want that to come out. But I don't think it's something so major that's making him feel like he's sort of not able to say anything against him. I think it's just this non... there's no desire to kick up the dust on that front. I have no idea why, but I think it has to do with finances. I don't think it's necessarily to do with the elections, but there's stuff going on there.
Yeah, and I hate speculating on these things about like whether Putin has something on Trump and Trump is just willingly
So we don't have the information.
That's the thing. It's like
but I'm totally gonna speculate. I think what's been happening.
I mean, as a journalist, I don't like to speculate just because like I like to form my opinions based on what the facts are and what we know.
Well, from what we know and even what Sarah just said, there have been these business ties. I think there's been clear instances of money laundering where you've got these Russian oligarchs buying property from Trump at way, way above value and just then selling it back to him way below low value. It could just be that Trump is really scared about the whole taxes stuff and the Russia stuff because there's a connection there.
That's a good point to bring up because, you know, oftentimes the cover-up is worse than the crime. We saw it with Nixon. You know, we saw it with, see it with a number of other things. But I think Trump at this point, his head has been on a swivel for so long with this Russia collusion story that anything that could drum up, I almost feel like this is a distraction in some ways just because like he wants people to think or talk about the administration in a certain way. And that's a common tactic, too. And it's a common tactic because he's able to use it to then go, say, sign an executive order and then go ahead and attack the media in turn saying, why didn't you cover this executive order? And then rally his base to be like, oh, we hate the media. Don't trust a word they say. It's almost like a vicious cycle in which he can actually continue to drum up support from his base by making it about the media and kind of sending them chasing their tail.
Yeah, you know, I was told the last time we talked about the Repeal Replace Act and the fact that they didn't come up with something, and he threw out this tweet about transgender in the military was kind of like a red herring too.
So Suraj, that would make sense to me if it were for the fact that the media actually did not cover. They cover all of it. They cover the polls. They cover the executive orders. It's not true. It's a talking point that the fake news media is not covering these stories, the positive stuff or any of the any kind of, you know, they covered the sanctions against North Korea, which was a win for the administration.
I'm not saying it's not true. I'm saying is that it is a tactic he uses to gin up support from his base by making
sure,
it about
that makes
the
sense.
Media.
But Suraj, how does he pick what he's going to tweet about to be the red herring? Because that in itself is dangerous. It's like there's an issue going on and then suddenly you throw out a tweet. Like, does he have an advisor that's kind of telling him, well, tweet about this? I mean,
I don't think any advisor tells him what to do.
Exactly.
When it comes to
Twitter. I think it could be, I mean, it's obviously a lot more dangerous than we perceive it.
I think he has like a spinning Rolodex, and it's like a, it's like almost like a Connect Four. Like you drop one minority group into the slot, and then you match it up with, okay, transgender, military, ban. Okay, got it. Go. And that's why he tweets.
Well, okay, we're going to move on now because that, literally we just covered a very small portion of this week's, some of the news that came out of the White House this week. I'm going to move on, and then we've got some big, big things to talk about, big stories that Sarah's going to cover. And of course, we're going to talk about North Korea. But another, there was a little Memogate, not a little, but a Memogate scandal that kind of broke this week. And we're not talking about the Google memo, which is also really interesting. I would love to talk about that, but it's not connected to the White House. So I'm talking about this other memo that just recently, I think Foreign Policy got a hold of the entire memo that was written by Rich Higgins. Now, we spoke last week about McMaster cleaning house, how he's been doing that. He's fired a number of folks from the National Security Council. Higgins was one of those people. He was in the Strategic Planning Office of the NSC, and he wrote a memo, apparently, a few months ago called POTUS and Political Warfare. He apparently wrote it in his political capacity. It's dated. Yep, it's dated from May. And it's a really, have either one of you read this memo, by the way?
I have not seen it, actually.
Me neither.
Okay. If you Google POTUS and Political Warfare, Higgins, Foreign Policy, the entire memo is there. But basically, here's what it talks about. It is a kind of a sweeping, and some folks would say conspiratorial, view of what it describes as a multi-pronged attack on the Trump White House. I know, Suraj, you also have some opinions about this phenomena, and we're going to talk about that in a minute. But in the memo, Higgins says that Trump is being attacked because he represents an existential threat to cultural Marxist theme memes that dominate the prevailing cultural narrative. And I want to read the different entities and groups that Higgins identifies as being threatening to the president. Number one, the mainstream media. Number two, academia. Number three, the deep state. Number four, global corporates and bankers, which is odd to me because I consider Trump to be part of that group. Number five, Democratic leadership, but also Republican leadership. So it's almost everybody you can imagine. And what this memo apparently represents is kind of this broader political struggle inside the White House between McMaster and alt-right operatives like Bannon, who have a very different worldview. They think that the Army General and all his folks are subverting the president's agenda. And even though McMaster wasn't called up by name, the document describes people that it seems like, you know, includes McMaster. McMaster read this, he got upset, and that probably also helped lead to the firing. He's trying to clean house of these kinds of elements, I think, in the White House.
I find it interesting that they always focus on the president's agenda, and yet none of us really know what that is.
The president's working that out.
Build the wall.
Build a wall. He's taking meetings on the golf course. What are you talking about? He's a busy man. But another thing that's interesting about this memo is not just the contents of the memo, which I think are just straight up crazy, but I also think the story of the memo and how it's been traveling inside the White House is also fascinating, because apparently the memo somehow got to Donald Trump Jr., the son of the president, who then himself sent it to his father, who loved it, apparently. And by the way, the president did not know that Higgins had been fired until he saw it on Fox News that McMaster had fired Higgins, the author of this memo, which he loved, and that really upset him. So this raises a few questions. Number one is this. Why is Don Jr., who has no clearance and does not have a role at the White House, getting a White House memo? Number one.
It's not a classified memo. Is it?
It's not, but it's...
I mean, it's out there in the media. You just got a hold of it.
But don't you think this whole really closeness with Ivanka and Don... I mean, like, there's no separation between the family and the administration.
I'm more concerned about the fact that he doesn't know when someone in his immediate circle is being fired by another person in his immediate circles, and just serves that there's just chaos everywhere.
Yeah. I mean, it's chaotic, one. No one knows what's going on because... there are so many different competing factors. And if you recall, I mean, you know, Reince Priebus brought in two people, Sean Spicer and Kate Walsh. I believe it's Kate Walsh. And all three of them are gone. So it was an opportunity now for Bannon to basically storm the castle and try to fill in as many people as he could. And he's actually getting stymied by H.R. McMaster, by John Kelly, even by Jim Mattis, because, you know, Kelly and Mattis, they have this agreement to, like, keep tabs on Trump at all times.
Hey, Siraj, did you feel what I felt when Priebus left? It was like, I mean, it wasn't exactly perfect, but it was this little remnant of the GOP's kind of like something that tied the White House into the legislative branch a little bit, because, you know, Priebus was sort of RNC, GOP, you know. And I just felt like, okay, now if the traditional, sort of traditional guy's been kicked out, now what?
Yeah, there was a lot of questions. First of all, John Kelly as chief of staff, that was the more pressing question for me. Like, Priebus being gone, like, that was actually, like, a good thing for the Trump White House, because it didn't seem like anything was going well.
No, I get it. It's just, I felt like there's going to be a bigger rift between more traditional conservatives and the White House.
I mean, there's already a huge rift. It probably will get even bigger. And, you know, it's concerning for passing his legislative agenda, which they've already had trouble on. And, you know, what pro-Trump Republicans really need to do, and this goes into 2018, and I'm not sure this is something that you wanted to expand on more, but they really need to primary the establishment Republicans who are currently sitting in the Senate and the House to try to move forward on his agenda, because they're just not getting the votes they need because they have too many moderate Republicans. And, you know,
Tell me what you were saying about Kelly. Yeah.
What would I say about Kelly, or if I were Kelly?
Yeah, you were going to say something really interesting about Kelly.
I mean, like, the thing about Kelly is that his tenure at the Department of Homeland Security was very tenuous. It was even more chaotic in DHS than it was in the White House. The only reason I say that is because, you know, the travel ban, with that going back and forth, being implemented without Kelly's knowledge the first time around. Remember, it was drafted by Steve Miller and I believe Steve Bannon. And you could tell the language that was being used in the original travel ban. And then it constantly got, you know, refurbished and constantly blocked by the courts. And in many ways, when people say they don't think that Trump has a handle on the White House, Kelly did not really have a handle on DHS. And that can go back to where people think about the deep state and how they're trying to, you know, throw off this agenda of Trump's and basically not put in political appointees who are qualified for those cabinet positions underneath Kelly or underneath any other cabinet member to kind of move forward on implementing those policies. And so that's where you kind of ran into a lot of red tape, at least if you were in support of those bans, you run into a lot of red tape because you're not able to implement it the way that...
Wait a minute. Maybe I'm just reading this totally differently, because for me, I mean, like, you know, Kelly's tenure at DHS was chaotic because of the failure of process by the White House to do it properly, right? I mean, Kelly, by the way, also was asked twice before he finally said yes the third time to being the chief of staff. He did not... This is not a position that he...
Didn't know Trump at all before being hired.
Right. And I also wonder, you know, you mentioned the deep state, which was also mentioned in the memo. It comes up over and over again by Trump supporters. I mean, there are people who argue that McMaster is part of the deep state. These generals who have served the country and, you know, DOD, you know, for decades, that they are also part of the deep state. And what I wonder is, when people talk about the deep state, to me, those are institutional elements that basically keep us stable. It's like the institutional memory that keeps us moving forward as a country. But painting that as something nefarious,
I said chaotically stable. Somehow we remain afloat.
So the idea, you know, I wanted to talk about the idea of the deep state. I mean, like, why, if we're talking about the same thing and we're identifying these same elements, kind of these institutional elements as being deep state, and they're just, it's this continuity of government. Since when has this become a terrible thing?
I don't think it is actually a terrible thing. I think most Trump's, I think most Trump supporters would think it's the worst thing ever. But it's so much bureaucracy that you're trying to undo that it's going to go way beyond Trump's 4 to 8 years of undoing before you actually see anything happen. The idea of draining the swamp is something that is a pipe dream. And if you want to pardon the pun, for Trump to basically drain all the swamp is really to basically close pretty much every executive agency. And he's not going to do that because that would pretty much...
He's not doing it, but he's also not appointing many, many, you know, dozens and dozens of positions that need to be filled.
And it goes back to the argument that the deep state is actually blocking those appointments before they even go up for a vote. There's always that pre-negotiation period where you're like, if I've, you know, nominated this person, like, what's the likelihood that they're going to get the number of votes to, like, pass confirmation? And usually the conversation
all I know is
dead.
Betsy DeVos is our Secretary of Education. I feel like, you know, we've got people in all kinds of positions that do not belong there. And so that does not seem like a fair argument. I feel like, you know, there are very, very prominent positions that got filled by people that there was incredible protest against. And so some of these other positions that we need, the, you know, just for government to run, would not be met with the same kind of backlash. I feel like it's just Trump not spending enough time on these issues and golfing. But I could be wrong.
I mean, yeah, him not being an actual politician and not being nuanced in all policy. I mean, you could really tell the difference between him and Obama, because Obama was actually getting on the phones and actually talking shop when it came to Obamacare and the ACA and trying to get no's to yeses in both the House and the Senate. And you're just not seeing that with Trump, because, you know, when the American Health Care Act in the House came to fruition and they finally got a vote, but the first time they got a vote, that was actually a no vote because they actually didn't vote on it. They were going to. Steve Bannon basically came through and just like was like threatening House members who were on the fence are going to say no, that, you know, they were going to be out of office in 2018. And they just, you know, it didn't move the needle for them. How are you going to respond to a threat if, you know, you realize that they can't actually do anything to take you out of office? I think right now we are back to where we were right before House Majority Whip Steve Scalise was shot during, you know, that whole horrific shooting at the Congressional Republican baseball practice in June. I'm hearing things right now that, like, Pink, the singer, she just released a new song called What About Us. It's good. It's a good song. Although I am so jaded by everything that comes from, you know, musicians, celebrities, comedians, that anything that I hear, I consider it could be possibly anti-Trump. And
what?
I do that too. I look out for lyrics and names of songs and themes, and I go, oh, this is like about the current administration and how we are living these days under that paradigm.
Yeah. So
could there be some projection happening here?
There could be some projection. I mean,
no, it's just knowing that this is like the nemesis. This is like the worst thing that, you know, liberal artists could dream of.
Yeah. So, I mean, like, just this week, I mean, a bunch of Emmy nominees, like, you know, Billy Eichner, you know, Sarah Silverman, that, you know, they're asked questions like, if they ruled the world, what would they do? And like, their first thing is they will kick Donald Trump off the planet. And then, you know, you have this Pink song, and just like everything that comes out, I can't get past the fact that somehow it might be anti-Trump. With obviously, even though it's so subtle, because she doesn't mention him by name. She just kind of talks about, you know, these various themes about like being sold down the river, or like, you know, kind of like they were ready and willing and then they were fooled in the end. And if you go and listen to the song, you'd understand what my sentiments are, because it could absolutely sound like an anti-Trump anthem.
I feel like it might be a case of, you know, that you're so vain, you probably think this song.
But it's not about me. It's about Trump.
Right. No, but here's the thing, though. It's only about him if you think what those people are saying applies to him, right?
Mm.
Yeah.
Like, if this is a truth about him.
What's that Katy Perry song? The one where she's...
Chained to the Rhythm?
Yeah, I thought that was about how we are now, our situation.
I mean, with Katy Perry, I mean, she was such a strong
supporter. She was vocal.
Yeah, she was such a strong supporter of Hillary Clinton. It was kind of hard to look past that. Whereas Pink, you know, she's been kind of silent for the last 5 years. She hasn't released any solo material since 2012. So...
Someone's a Pink fan.
I had to do my research before writing about it, okay?
Oh, wow.
Because I wrote about it. The way I write is just, am I hearing this right? Is it just me that I am hearing that this Pink song is about Trump? Or am I just too cynical that I can't see anything without thinking it has to do with Trump?
No, listen, artists are supposed to bring up the most pressing issues of our time. And so it's natural to look for those nuances in their songs. So, yeah, I think we're all looking at.
And let's say it is. So what? So what's the problem?
Oh, no. I mean, that just kind of reaffirms the fact that, you know, celebrities, musicians and comedians hate Trump. And, you know, no matter what Trump does, they're going to hate him. And we're just getting to the point where we might have another James Hodgkinson come and shoot up someone for their political differences. And that's problematic.
Why do you think the songs incite that?
Oh, my goodness. Wait a minute. No. Are you saying that liberal hate of Trump will incite violence against Trump? Or Trump supporters, or is that what you're saying?
I'm not saying that anyone can get inspired by anything. With a John Lennon shooter, what was he inspired by? Catcher in the Rye, right? Wasn't that something that was like, how do you draw right. Catcher in the Rye to go and shoot John Lennon? That's the thing, is like anybody can be inspired for any reason to do any horrific act. And it's just like terrorism. How do you, I mean, of course, there are questionable passages in the Quran, but for the most part, you know, most Muslims are peaceful and don't want to go shoot and kill somebody in the name of religion. But yet some people do, and they pick and choose, you know, they may assign blame to anything and say, that's what inspired me to go commit this atrocity. And there'd be no way to tell them differently because they're insane.
So you know what? My brain is a little bit blown right now because you're talking about assigning blame. And I know you probably know that a mosque was bombed. A Minnesota mosque was bombed this past week. And the only response out of the administration that Trump didn't say anything about it was a response from Gorka, I think it was, who said that we have concerns that this might be a liberal attack that's been planned to make, I don't know who look bad, but they think.
I have a problem with that because I'm trying to step away from this. Okay, everyone wants Trump to say something every time something happens to a Muslim, right? And I get that. But at the same time, I'm trying to understand if something is about law enforcement and local law enforcement and it's like a criminal act, why does the president have to say something every single time?
He doesn't. But I think when there are acts of terrorism in this country, everybody says something. And so it's because it was an act of terrorism. As far as I'm concerned, the governor of the state believes it's an act of terrorism against a house of worship.
So case
it's
closed.
Not a small deal.
They've decided how to deal with it. So why should the
case
president
closed.
Always have-
The president of the United States should comment on acts of terrorism in
well,
his country.
Well, depends on who's tagging it as quote-unquote terrorism.
I wish I drank. Times like this make me want to drink.
I've been told that I should.
I will just say this. I don't like to comment on or speculate on who may have bombed that mosque. I do think it would have been more prescient and probably better optics if Trump had addressed it. And the failure of him to do that probably says more about him and his tone deafness to other communities in the United States than anything.
Well, we should get real, though. He hasn't commented on most of it. Yeah.
I understand Sarah's point. He should not comment on every single thing.
Or if you're going to comment, maybe make your comment so a little bit less reprehensible. I'm talking about the substance of that statement. To me, that is not that much different than you saying, well, you know, liberal criticism of Trump could lead to people committing acts of terror. And then you have this actual act of terror that the administration wants to ignore and say, well, maybe it was
anything that comes out of Gorka's mouth. Are you going to take that seriously? I mean,
that's not a pass. It's not a pass.
It's not a pass. But then you have to understand
he's a national security advisor.
They're probably trying to, I don't know, deflect from the whole issue. So, I mean, who's listening to them anyway? The fact is it was done.
First of all, what is Gorka's actual role in the White House? Because I still am not 100% sure.
I just know he showed up in my LinkedIn feed.
you should connect to
him. He's a counterterrorism advisor. I think he is the go-to counterterror expert in the White House.
We know Sebastian Gorka's reputation. He has, anti-Muslim leanings. I am not expecting something miraculous out of this White House when it comes to addressing terrorism directed towards Muslims. The only time I've actually heard anything that was even remotely favorable towards Muslims was Trump's Saudi Arabia speech. And he actually addressed all the, millions of, or thousands of Muslims who have been killed or targeted by groups like the Islamic State or Al-Qaeda. And that was actually a good step forward. So like what we're seeing right now in Minnesota, I would just like to, let them investigate until we can assign blame to, whether it was done by someone who hates Muslims versus someone who may actually be a Muslim. So
I think what was shocking to me about it is not so much that they will not be supportive of a Muslim community at a time like this, but the fact that they are willing to assign blame to liberals at large.
Yeah, that's crazy. You don't get into that.
That's what's really shocking. But you know what? Okay, so let's move on. I was going to talk. I'm not going to discuss this. I just want to let people know this is happening. There is apparently Vice News. It's a crazy story. Please just read it. I actually wanted to read large portions of it. We don't have time. But there's a Vice story that broke about how twice a day, in the morning and then in the afternoon, a folder is created of positive things. Statements and images and even pictures of Trump looking powerful. They create this folder, they take it to the president so he can look at it twice a day to make himself feel better. Apparently when there aren't enough positive chyrons, like things that people, and by the way, the RNC staffers are being used to help create this folder twice a day. Communication staffers will ask them if you can't find enough positive headlines about Trump, then please just send flattering photographs. Our tax dollars are paying for this, by the way.
It seems like psychotherapy. It's psychotherapy.
If it's the RNC, is it really taxpayer funded?
Well, but it's not just the RNC. The RNC is where it starts. They start by doing kind of the RNC staffers don't just do this. They actually keep an eye all day. They look at media and then from that, they'll pull bits to send to the communication office at the White House. And from that, the communications office will pull positive things for Trump. And the only feedback that apparently the communication shop has given to the RNC staffers is it needs to be more fucking positive. There's not enough stuff there. Anyhow, it could just be that, like you said, there's all this horrible hate towards Trump. And so he needs his spirits kept. I just thought this was a crazy story. Read it if you can. It's on Vice.
Obama didn't really need that because obviously, with the exception of Fox News and Breitbart, he was probably getting praised virtually every day by the media. And
do you think he did not deserve the praise?
Well, here's the thing, and this is just me being a cynic. I don't think any politician should be praised that much, regardless.
I agree.
No matter what party you fall on, and this is why I have such a hard time, stomaching a lot of these politicians who are being kind of forced down their throat, like Maxine Waters. Like, what has she done? She's actually probably one of the more corrupt politicians in the House, with bank fraud allegations in which her one of her family members was actually convicted. It's just one of those things where, why should you elevate these people to the point of where in which they're idols to only then, have it all come crashing down because they're human, for one, and humans are prone to error. And when you're a politician, usually this is the philosophical argument. Great men are almost always, evil men. And this is just something that, I don't think any politician should be.
That's part of our culture. I think we're just so used to doing that. And we did that with Trump, too. I think, getting somebody up to that level and then realizing who you really did elect,
I feel like much of the country, including conservatives in this country, did not do that to Trump during the election. But then they had to kind of swallow their criticism once he became the nominee.
That was a secret Trump vote right there. And that's what nobody saw.
Exactly.
I know plenty of Republicans who did not like Donald Trump, but ended up voting for him in swing states, even because they just did not want Hillary Clinton to win.
Speaking of supporting Trump in the GOP leadership, we know that a lot of these folks were reluctant, but then they stepped up their game. And I think when he took the oath in January, I think they rallied around him. But he has not rewarded that loyalty, it seems to me. He's repeatedly calling out all kinds of from Sessions, and now he's moved on to Mitch McConnell. And I'm going to hand it over to Sarah. Tell us about what has been going on here.
Well, I think it's a classic result of something that wasn't you know, properly forecasted on the part of the GOP. But in general, I think now Trump's whole tone towards, you know, the Senate and how it's fallen short in the healthcare department and then possibly in tax reform and is just coming more to the forefront. And there's a little clip of exactly what he said when it came to a question, I guess, about whether or not McConnell should step down.
Well, I'll tell you what, if he doesn't get repeal and replace done, and if he doesn't get taxes done, meaning cuts and reform, and if he doesn't get a very easy one to get done, infrastructure, if he doesn't get them done, then you can ask me that question.
So the question is, people are asking if McConnell should be removed. And the truth is, a president can't remove the Senate Majority Leader. He just can't do that. So that's like just even entertaining that idea is part of that whole bravado. And then the only way to get rid of a Senate Majority Leader is to actually vote him off. And the Senate's not about to do that. It seems to me like when there's a failure in any of these bills or these big changes that he wanted to bring in as a, you know, with his new administration, it's kind of like that totally hands off, you know, hot potato style. Okay, well, the ball's in your court now. You failed. You dropped it. You dropped the potato, you know. So the cabinet doesn't work. And then it kind of like he has no contribution coming from the executive branch to make that legislative move happen, which is what the traditional way of doing it is. It's like the executive branch and the legislative branch, they work together to get something out there. So if he's standing there and saying it's all Mitch McConnell's fault, which, by the way, you know, he did say, look, I've been asking for this for 2 years and they didn't come up with something in the 2 years that I've been pushing for this. It's almost like a little kid saying, you know, I asked for this and it didn't happen. And so my hands are washed clean of any responsibility towards planning for it or helping towards it. So anyway, you know, talking about getting him removed, I think was just, it's mind-boggling how the conversations can even go that way, because the Senate doesn't generally, you know, the question is, does the Senate have more power than the president? And the answer is no, because what the Senate does is it certifies the results of the election along with the House. It also passes legislation. It approves appointments. But, you know, the appointments have to first be made by the president, but so they can't initiate those appointments. They also try to impeach, but the impeachment has to start from the House level. They hold committee hearings, you know, and it all, it only expels its own members, which means it has to have a two-third majority vote for that. So together, the House and the Senate do have more power than the president, but you know, to be even entertaining that idea, I think is just there's no understanding of how stuff works.
Well, can we just take a step back, because I mean, we're getting into kind of some of the micro stuff, but what do you take away from this very public repeated attack on Mitch McConnell? I mean, do you think, Suraj, like you said earlier, sometimes these are distraction tactics from other things that are happening? And how is this being received in the traditional GOP establishment?
I mean, the GOP establishment hates it. They're all rallying behind Mitch McConnell. But again, the Mitch McConnell, he kind of shot himself in the foot on this one, because if you recall back when Obamacare was first being drafted, he complained about how their backroom deals and how closed door meetings were kind of preventing people from seeing how the bill was being drafted. Therefore, we had no way of knowing what it actually was. In turn, when they presented what they had, the Better Care Reconciliation Act, through the Senate, they drafted that through backroom deals, and it just looked terrible in terms of optics. So why, for a lot of these senators, who, you know, moderate Republicans who are up for re-election, voting for that, at least, you know, if they knew their state, you know, they know better than pretty much everyone else in the Senate, why would you vote for that if you know that you're up for re-election and you could possibly get unseated and not ever have a chance of, you know, coming back to Washington again? For them, I guess it goes back to like the career aspirations of wanting to stay in Washington and the whole draining the swamp versus, you know, actually getting good legislation passed. I think if you want to look at the Obamacare repeal and replacement plan, it just was not, it was basically Obamacare light. Then they wanted to do a straight up repeal, failed, because there was no replacement. And the thing is they're trying to rush it. And I don't think it's actually a distraction for that Trump is sending us on. I actually think he legitimately feels this way. It's the same way with Jeff Sessions.
But I think it's much deeper than that. I think it's not about the president or Mitch McConnell. I think this is about the Senate in general. I mean, they only have a narrow majority of those 52 seats against the 48 that the Democrats have. And I think they consistently show support for Trump on stuff in a very strong way because they know that they're hanging on by their fingernails. And to me, that just this whole indication that they're unable to get something done, but they yet still stand behind this man is an indication of actually their weakness. They're trying to stay together, trying to be,
that's a good point.
You know, fortify each other. And that worries me as a conservative. I'm like, we could potentially lose the Senate. And that to me is a huge, big deal. But that's what I get frustrated about, because I tell my kids, you know, you can't go around telling the neighborhood how to treat you unless you have your house in order. And my thing here is, you know, the Republicans in the Senate, you know, they don't have their act together at district levels, at local levels. And I have like a laundry list of stuff that I saw at local politics, in at the level of local politics, that I thought were wrong with the party that needed to be fixed in order. So some of those things are that, you know, we're not accepting of the diversity in the voting districts that Republicans sit in. They're not cognizant of the new demographics in lots of areas. There's less compassion for the poor, and there's no inclusiveness, and there's also no understanding of how new technologies and are changing jobs, and people are more focused on these traditional jobs. There's several districts that have redistricting issues, and some bleed into the legal arena where they're sent to Supreme Court level because, you know, local districts can't figure it out. And then we're always so focused on winning and the party politics of it, we don't look at other things. And the fact that, you know, Republicans consistently play the money game at any cost, but that allows them to cater to extreme elements within their districts as well. And they've consistently stayed in their comfort zones all the time, trying to play the traditional camps. And I think these are all a recipe for why the Senate is just hanging in there. And to me, it's like, this is the bigger problem and not so much Trump versus McConnell.
Well, that could be, but it's weird for Democrats to watch this happen, to watch, you know, a Republican president attack Republican Senate majority leader. We cannot end this episode without talking about the fact that we might all die in a nuclear firestorm.
I mean, we all will die.
We all will die for sure. But I'm not even kidding. I actually did. I got to play this clip.
North Korea best not make any more threats to the United States. They will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen. He has been very threatening beyond a normal statement. And as I said, they will be met with fire, fury, and frankly, power, the likes of which this world has never seen before. Thank you.
All right. When I first heard this clip, I didn't even realize, but I had kind of a stress reaction. I ate an entire bag of Bugles like throughout the night as I kept reading about this. And it was a complete stress reaction. It's not because I'm a fatty, but I am. But I was so kind of shocked and horrified at this. I felt like blustering by the president and posturing with somebody who is not a very stable individual to begin with. Okay. And by the way, for the record, I did also Google how to build a nuclear bunker. I did actually look that up. Now let me just explain, give a little bit of background about like kind of like the series of events that led us to this proclamation by the president. If you recall, the United Nations recently issued sanctions unanimously against North Korea. In retaliation, North Korea threatened to retaliate thousands of times over, in quotes, against the United States. Those sanctions, of course, were fairly potent. Now, in a New York Times op-ed, Susan Rice writes that August is a particularly sensitive month for North Korea because it's the month that the U.S. and South Korea conduct major joint military exercises that always sets Pyongyang on edge. And then apparently a couple years ago, you know, there was actually during these exercises some cross-border artillery exchange. So between the military exercises and these sanctions, you know, between all of these things, leadership in North Korea is a little stressed out. And it doesn't really help, I think, to have our president respond like this. After Trump said this, Kim Jong-un then said that he was going to fire a volley of ballistic missiles in the general direction of Guam, of all places, poor Guam. And then Trump comes back and says the next day that maybe the fire and fury statement, which, by the way, was improv and it wasn't even planned, which a lot of people interpreted as a threat of nuclear war, that maybe that was actually not tough enough. So I don't know what's tougher than fire and fury and power. All right. First of all, can I get your reactions about the Fire and Fury statement?
I would say that, you know, Trump's best comments always come off the cuff. When it comes to North Korea, I think, one, he's taking the bait on whatever Kim Jong-un and the North Korean regime is kind of sending out there. And I heard it from a colleague in the newsroom that he should need, and part of my French, that he needs to shut the fuck up and just play some golf. And and it's just funny to me because this is coming obviously from the conservative right side, and, you know, escalation with North Korea, obviously not a good thing. I don't think that we actually will go to war with North Korea. It is obviously tough talk. But, you know, in a similar token, and to use Trump's words, some politicians and some leaders are all talk and no action.
I don't think it's going to escalate because I've been listening to a couple of, you know, news reports and some deeper analyses. And I realized that we like to paint Kim as this crazy madman. And I used to love calling him Madman Kim. But he's pretty calculated, apparently, and it's about the survival of the regime. It's not so much this I want to go out in a blast of fury thing for him. So he's calculating stuff, which is actually a little bit more scary. But at this point, it just looks like two men having this little bellicose kind of back and forth. And it's just all this bravado and craziness. And it, I don't think McMaster and you know, Mattis and the head of the Pentagon and all those other people are stupid. They know what's going on. And I think they're going to calm him down and, you know, get him to do the right thing, hopefully. Yeah.
Yeah. And even if North Korea launches a ballistic missile, it cannot reach Washington, D.C. So us three will be good.
I got relatives we'll be good on the other coast.
We'll be good for now. Well, you know, some folks are asking, like, why Guam? So I just want to give, like, 1 minute background on Guam. In 1898, the U.S. took this island from Spain, and we've been using this as a strategic outpost in the Pacific ever since. We have an airfield, a naval station, almost 200,000 Americans, of which 7,000 are military personnel. So, you know, Guam didn't come out of left field. You know, there's a reason that Kim Jong-un is talking about Guam. In the Pacific theater, Guam would be a prime target. But of course, you know, if there was an actual attack on Guam, North Korea would be wiped out. And that's been made clear. I mean, they obviously do not have the firepower we have. But on this, you know, you said that, well, you know, the generals will talk him down, but apparently the Pentagon already has a very specific plan for a preemptive strike on North Korea's missile sites if Trump decides to order the attack. Two senior military officials told NBC News that the key to the plan would be a B-1B heavy bomber attack coming out of Anderson Air Force Base in Guam. And the training has been accelerating since May, according to officials. So in an actual mission, the non-nuclear bombs would be supported by satellites and drones. And so there is not a nuclear plan of attack right now, but it doesn't mean that it's off the table, I think. And because we are running out of time today, I think what we'll do is we will push the discussion of the constitutionality or even the possibility of Trump ordering a nuclear attack. Like, what can he even do that, right? And what is the law on that, and what that would might actually look like if we actually went through that to next week, because of course,
but you know, Rabia, and just on a last thought on this thing is this just shows that the sanctions are really working, because that regime has really made its people suffer, and they're like way, way, way behind economically. And so I think him speaking up this much is a clear indication of that, which means, you know, I don't know if the regime's in danger.
It seems like they're working much harder to fit these little mini nuclear warheads into ballistic missiles. I mean, it seems like they're actually accelerating their nuclear program.
Well, it's because they're feeling the pressure, perhaps. But yeah, the economy's not doing well.
That's not sanctions working, though, right? Isn't that like what the sanctions are designed to prevent?
Well, what's sanctions that? Are working to make the people suffer, but they're obviously he's doing what he has to do, and he would have done that regardless.
Well, I don't think the United States wants people to suffer, the North Korean people to suffer. I think what we want is to prevent them from having nuclear capabilities and destabilizing that entire region. So to that extent, the question is, how do you then handle this threat? And that's an entire other conversation, which we'll just have to follow up with, unless, Siraj, you have some quick thoughts.
Yeah, to go with Sarah's point about the survival of their regime and their people, I don't think Kim Jong-un and his regime are that stupid to want to go out in a blaze of glory, and they will want to survive as much as they possibly can, given the fact that they're so isolated against the entire world that's united against them. It's just not going to happen. The airstrikes may happen, but I don't think a full-on ground war like we would see in Iraq or Afghanistan would happen.
Agreed.
All right, so I'm going to counter with this. And that is this. I think that that regime, which, by the way, is also based on kind of this idea of pure blood, like, a, you know, there's a whole weird thing behind that about how they believe that they are like these ordained people of a particular bloodline who should rule the Koreas. I think that if the U.S. was looking to strike, I think they would get out. They would leave their people. They do not care about their people. They would preserve their little special bloodline, and they would be gone. Kim and his buddies and his family probably survive it anyways, is what I'm thinking. And they would come back to clean up the nuclear waste probably. But anyway, I could be wrong. Let's hope none of this comes to pass. Anyhow, thank you, Suraj, so much for joining us this week.
I really appreciate it.
It was a great conversation. Sarah, thank you.
Yeah,
and
thanks,
I hope you get settled
Suraj.
Soon.
Thanks.
All right, guys, we're going to wrap up this week's episode, and we will see you back next week.
Big thanks to all our listeners for tuning in to the 45th podcast week after week. And if you'd like to give us further support, you can do that by becoming a patron at patreon.com/45thpod. By doing so, you can become a supporter and patron for as little as $5 a month. And to do so, again, go to patreon.com/45thpod. A shout out and thank you to our sponsors. They make this program possible. And I urge our listeners to please check out our sponsors and use their products. And thank you to them for helping us produce week after week. Thank you to our audio producer, Hannah McCarthy, our executive producer, Meethal Thelhan. We have been produced by Long Arc Digital Media, and you can find us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Our handle is at 45th Pod. Our website is www.45thpod.com. And guess what? You can even leave us a voice message. Call us at 202-670-8345. And you never know, we might just play your message on the air. Thanks again for tuning in. See you next week. We're talking. Wait a minute, a second. I can't remember what my lead in.
We're talking about the giant inflatable Trump chicken in the White House.
Oh, I love that chicken. I mean, that should be actually. That should be the. What is that, by the way? Can somebody tell me what that is?
It looked like an Elvis hairstyle on that chicken.
It was supposed to be Trump. It was supposed to be Trump, I think.
Yeah, I know. It is Trump's chicken. Okay.